Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, Episode 204, Interview with Michael Underwood, Marketing Manager of Angry Robot Books. This episode is brought to you by The Wild Boys, a novel by Travis Heerman.
It's basically about the business of writing, and they tell you the stuff they wish that someone had told them when they got started as writers.
You know, somebody can be a successful marketer and not necessarily provide a quality product.
I'm going to let Moses go because he's frothing at the mouth to talk about this one.
I like writing. I like reading. I like to immerse myself in books. That seems like a pretty good career choice.
Domo arigato, Mr. Roboto.
Oh, you sound terrible. What happened? I'm just kidding.
Oh, man.
And now, podstructed on a zeppelin by an apprentice mage and delivered by a rocket ship to a benevolent dragon, Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing.
Welcome to Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing, your podcast for science fiction and fantasy literature. This is Sean Farrell. As you can tell, I've been a little under the weather, so please excuse my voice. It'll be back to normal soon, I'm sure. Today we are joined, courtesy of Timothy C. Ward, by Michael Underwood, marketing manager of Angry Robot Books and author of Geekomancy. The first part of this interview, Tim and Michael discuss the actual business of selling a book, as well as some other topics, including educational experiences that Michael recommends for anyone who wants to work in publishing. In part two of this interview, which we will release soon, Tim and Michael will discuss the actual book, Geekomancy. So I think this is a great interview for anyone who is thinking about publishing a book, writing a book, or is just interested in the business of selling books. After the interview, I'll be back for just a couple of brief minutes. But for now, let's go ahead and get into our interview with Michael.
Welcome to the show, Michael R. Underwood. He is the author of Geekomancy, out by, is it Pocket Star Books?
Yes.
Pocket Star Books, and he's also the sales and marketing manager for Angry Robot Books in the United States. Welcome to the show, Michael.
Thanks. Glad to be here. And we mustn't forget our Canadian cousins. I cover North America, so also that territory for Chapters Indigo and all of our neighbors up top.
Okay, awesome. So I thought what I would like to do is ask you some questions about publishing and then about your book, Geekomancy and Urban Fantasy. And so in the first section, I'm doing a little series on preparing people for their careers, fans of speculative fiction, what the heck they can do to have a career that they enjoy. And I think you have one of the coolest careers out there. So I'm curious, before college, what kind of things do you think prepared you for this job?
For the Angry Robot job?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I worked in a game store from senior year in high school all the way through undergrad, and then left when I went off to do grad school. And, you know, it was retail experience. It was kind of publishing adjacent because it was in the games and kind of hobby world. So I learned a lot of customer service skills, which I think are important for everybody. I kind of wish that we had everybody needs to work customer service for at least 6 months in their life. Otherwise, you don't ever get to complain about bad service kind of a thing, because there's an empathy element. But I think learning how to just kind of interface and interact with someone you've never met and to try and form a human connection. You know, for me, as working at the game store, it was, what games are you excited about? Or, you know, are you shopping for some, you know, a friend, a loved one, for yourself? And to find those human connections through, in that case, games, but then kind of it built into any kind of hobby element, which now serves me well in books.
Okay. And so I may or may not have made a mistake by listening to your interview on the Roundtable podcast, because they did such an awesome job that
they do.
So, I mean, you know, I don't even try and compare to David's intros. But he, in that interview, you were talking about the major that you made up at Indiana University. How did your college education help you, and maybe what were some of the things you might have wished you'd done differently to prepare you for where you are?
Sure. Well, when I was a freshman, I had declared an intended major of East Asian language and culture, since I had kind of fallen in love with Japanese culture in junior high and high school, and I took Japanese all the way through high school and was planning on kind of pursuing that element and either going into translation or going and working for some company in Japan. And kind of that was my path. And I wanted to write somewhere in that career trajectory, but I didn't really know how that worked. And I hadn't really tapped into that passion. But when I was a freshman, I read Joseph Campbell's Hero with a Thousand Faces and the interview book that he did with Bill Moyers, The Power of Myth. And reading those two together really kind of opened my eyes to, hey, wait, there's this mythology as a scholarship thing that I could do as a way of kind of living my life. And the way that Campbell talked about kind of mythology across the world really got me thinking about how I could study mythology and then use that to write better. And it really inspired me to pursue storytelling. So I went to the individualized major program and kind of pitched them the idea. And I did a lot of legwork and logistics on my own to be able to put it together and, you know, show them that I was still being academically rigorous. So that was a huge amount of fun, and it was great for me to learn to do things myself and to kind of set my own standards and kind of organize my own time, since I had to do a lot of the logistics that in another major would already have been done for me. If I could go back now, I would probably try to take even a wider array of classes than I did. I ended up only taking one kind of astronomy and space science class, which taught me quite a bit in that summer about, you know, kind of hydrostatic equilibrium in suns, but that was about it. You know, I wanted meteors and nebulae and all that good kind of basic science stuff, but I didn't really engage with it as much as I could have. And if I were telling my just started college self, you know, classes to take, I'd be saying, take more social psychology, take more sociology, take some hard science, and, you know, expand my boundaries even more than I did when I was in college, where it was a lot of arts and humanities kinds of things from here and there, but not as much like really trying to stretch myself and kind of learn more about the world.
So then after that, you went and got your master's. How did that help you? And do you think that was the right path?
I think that it taught me a lot. When I went to the master's program, I was still kind of operating under the paradigm that I was going to become a professor, and then I was going to write during my off time, because I knew that there were science fiction and fantasy writers who were academics as their kind of day job career, and then they also wrote, and that was something that you could do. And so I went to University of Oregon to get a folklore degree, since Indiana University, where I did my BA, has a great folklore program, but I knew from kind of the academic scuttlebutt that it's best to have, you know, not all of your degrees come from the same school, because then you get more connections and so on and so forth. But in my master's degree, I focused mostly on fan culture and kind of geek culture. And this was from 2005 to 2007. So it was just in the earlier stages of geek stuff really getting incorporated into mass culture. And it was very interesting for me to kind of look at subcultural studies and some kind of English lit and film criticism, and to talk about both texts and kind of people and how people cluster themselves around texts. And I think that folklore really continues to pay off, not only in making it easier for me to come up with mythologies for fantasy settings or to kind of investigate the sociological implications of changing one thing in a science fiction story. But it's really directly informed geekomancy. You know, there was a scholar at, I think, Bowling Green, who presented on geekomancy for an undergraduate conference. And kind of the sources that he cited were all the sources that I had been reading when I was doing my grad work. So that scholarship is really very clearly, and more than I was thinking, informed the way that I write, and has kind of prepared me to be able to look at fan communities in a distinct way, which I think really fits how Angry Robot engages with the with the market being a very kind of reader-focused publishing house.
This episode is brought to you by The Wild Boys, a novel from Travis Heerman. One 16-year-old girl versus a plague of beast. Can a 16-year-old girl stem the tide of a lycanthropocalypse? When three younger boys show up at Mia's doorstep, naked and on the run, she is drawn into a shadow world where a series of strange disappearances heralds a slowly spreading plague of lycanthropy. Mia must save the three orphan boys from their brutal alpha, a man-beast who believes humans are food. A war is brewing from the top of the food chain. Mia doesn't know it yet, but she holds a key to the future of the human race. To learn more about The Wild Boys, written by our good friend Travis Heerman, author of Heart of the Ronin and Rogues of the Black Fury, please visit our website and click on the page for episode 204. There you'll find the image and the link for The Wild Boys by Travis Heerman.
So now, did you go to Clarion?
Yeah, I did Clarion West in 2007. So I graduated with my master's degree, having turned in my thesis 2 days previous, packed a bunch of stuff in my car, and then drove from Eugene to Seattle to go to Clarion West. And then 2 days into the workshop, my thesis advisor was like, hey, you have to change these things in your thesis. And I'm like, I'm at Clarion West. I want to be writing short stories, not fixing my thesis. But it ended up being fine. But I went right away from the master's straight into Clarion West and kind of disassembled and reassembled my brain to be more awesome at all things writing.
So then shortly after that is when you got your job. I want to say Osprey, but I'm not sure if that's... Who was the company that you were working for before Angry Robot Books?
Before Angry Robot, I was working as a field sales representative for a variety of publishers, working for Terry Weibel of Weibel Marketing. And before that, I actually did a little bit of retail because I finished my master's. I didn't get into a PhD program, so I moved back home and did a little bit of retail, and then I did about a year at Barnes & Noble, some cafe and some as a bookseller. And that was really where I started in publishing. And from Barnes & Noble, I went into being a field rep and did that for 3 years. And that was really what gave me the skills and put me in a position to be able to go work for Angry Robot.
So are you pretty happy that you didn't get into the PhD program?
I think retrospectively, I'm quite happy to be out of the academy. I've got some friends who are still in it, and some of them have kind of... The academy has actually treated them well, which I know a lot of people who are getting PhDs right now are finding a really hard market. And I'm in some ways glad that I didn't go into PhD programs when I would have wanted to, and then kind of come out with this degree and hopefully lots of amazing ideas into a market where I couldn't get a job, because I maybe could have gotten into publishing from there, but it would have been with a much higher student loan debt area, kind of total. And I'm very happy where I am. So I get lots of support for my writing, and it really makes me a far more informed writer than I would be if I wasn't working in publishing by day.
Yeah, I've been looking into that a little bit, and as far as like writing jobs in colleges, do you know many people that teach speculative fiction in college?
Let's see, do I? A good friend of mine who I met when I was in undergrad, Siobhan Carroll, who writes as Vaughn Carr, she is a professor of English, and she's gotten to start teaching a little bit of speculative fiction. Her main area is not explicitly in speculative fiction, but she gets to bring some in just because of the 18th century English lit focus that she has. And then I also know Gregory Wilson, and he teaches some spec fic, both writing and kind of English criticism of spec fic in Queens. So there's some people out there, and I've met Kidge Johnson a couple of times, and I applied to the NC State program where John Kessel teaches. So there's definitely some people here and there, very good scholars and very good writers, but that doesn't seem to be the path that I've taken, and I'm okay with it.
For someone that would like to get into this career field, how do you think you were able to get the Weibel job? Because you started at Barnes & Noble and those other things. That would be a good idea. What were you thinking about when you applied for this Weibel job, and why do you think that you were hired?
Well, I was looking to get something that was more stable, kind of like a career style job instead of just working retail, because I was pretty happy where I was, but it wasn't a lot of money. There weren't a whole lot of possibilities in a longer term for just working retail for me. And I really liked books, and I liked engaging with books, and the idea of that kind of a job was very appealing to me, because there's also a lot of getting to see other places in the country and getting to make connections around a really large area and visit friends who are elsewhere. I think to get that job, the most important things that I had were I had that master's degree, where I had proven that I could kind of absorb and recontextualize a lot of information at a fairly high level in doing the master's thesis that I did and the interviews and everything that went into that. You know, I had a scholarly background that showed that I had a certain level in terms of, you know, intellect or being able to process information. I had that bookstore experience, the things that I've been learning since I was working at the game store, of just making the one-to-one connection of being able to sell one person the right thing, whether that was a game at the game store or at Barnes & Noble, the right book. The art of the hand sell, I think, is really important. I think it's really important for anyone who works in publishing in a way that kind of they have to convince other people to get excited about a book, which is a big chunk of the industry. You know, authors sell to agents who sell to editors, and the editors sell the book to the rest of the house, and then the sales and marketing people sell it to the reps, and then the reps sell it to the bookseller, and then the bookseller sells it to the reader. There's a lot of people in that chain, which means there's a lot of possible enthusiasm, but you have to transmit enthusiasm. You have to be able to figure out how to talk about a book in the right way to really electrify somebody. So you have to know a little bit about them. You have to know a lot about the book, or at least you have to know what kind of a reader aesthetic it fits. You know, there are books that I didn't get to read as a rep, but I wasn't able to effectively sell them because I'd been given the right tools to talk about the book effectively. And I think for any writer, if you want to get into publishing, it'd probably be good to start to learn how to talk about books in terms of who they appeal to, and not necessarily just why the book appeals or doesn't appeal to you, because there's so many different reading aesthetics out in the field, you know, and definitely in publishing in a much larger fashion. So if you read just one or two subgenres, definitely read outside of your comfort zone. If you want to go into being an agent or an editor or work in sales and marketing, learn how to talk about books, you know, pretty quickly. You know, learn how to give elevator pitches for other people's books. And doing that, learning how to talk about other books will make it, or should make it, easier to talk about your own, so that then when someone asks, wait, so are you a writer as well? You can apply that same level of skill and kind of sales effectiveness to your own work. And that should serve a lot of writers in really good stead.
Okay, let's put this to practice a little bit. I was reading your blog at michaelrunderwood.com, and it shows that you've read Zen Scarlet, a strange chemistry book that's coming out soon.
Right.
I've been looking into that, and it looks really cool. Sell us on that book.
So Zen Scarlet, the thing that really struck me about the book is that it has a kind of classic science fiction sense. It has that sense of wonder, or the sense of wonder, if you smash all the words together in a very non-German kind of way. It gives me that same excitement, that kind of energy of kind of pure classic science fiction that a lot of other SF that I'm reading, it doesn't quite do it the same way. It might be really smart or compelling. It might be really emotionally compelling, like VN, or it might be just like an awesome kind of balls-to-walls action thing, Fortress Frontier by Mike Cole, or Three that I just finished by Jay Posey, which is another Angry Robot book coming. But what Zen Scarlet does is it takes that classic science fiction feel and it puts it into a story that is led, and led really well, by a female main character. So you've got kind of classic SF is normally male, but you've got a female character here. She's very much a teenager. She's very much a scientist. So it's a great book to kind of inspire and encourage like maybe teen girls who are looking or looking into or curious about science. So it can do a lot of different things. It can be just a sense of wonder book for an adult science fiction reader. It can be inspiration for a teen girl who maybe you want to get more excited about science, or so a girl who already is excited about science, to help them see themselves in the literature, which I think can go a long way to encouraging someone to pursue a dream.
Okay, and then another strange chemistry book, Emily in the Hollow World. How does that one compare or contrast?
So I'd say Emily in the Hollow World is going to be a little bit younger. It's closer to middle grade in terms of the tone and kind of the level of intensity and emotional maturity of the character. So this is a good book to maybe bridge someone who's been reading middle grade but is looking to kind of start reading up into teen. And what it does that I think is cool is it takes the Hollow World kind of trope that was in a fair amount of earlier science fiction, and we see in kind of the predecessor texts to contemporary science fiction, Journey to the Center of the Earth and things like that. And it freshens it up, and it brings in just enough steampunk to make it cool and hip, but you get this cool travelogue kind of story where Emily kind of accidentally ends up in this amazing center of the world story and gets caught up in all of this conflict between the underwater people, and then you've got this betrayal going on and court intrigue, and it throws a lot of things into one bowl, and it takes a cool, really spunky character through all of those things and gives you lots of cool stuff to look at. You know, it'd be a great kind of story to turn into a cartoon or a movie, and I think it's a really good way to take a teen reader who maybe hasn't read a lot of other science fiction and help introduce them into ideas that for maybe an adult science fiction reader don't seem as fresh, but for someone who's just getting in, it's a great way to introduce them to those texts without having to send them to a novel that's 50 years old and maybe won't be as accessible to a teen reader today.
I'm sorry. I feel bad because I'm rushing our questions in order to get them all in for this segment. There is so much we could talk about. With your job with Angry Robot Books, you have a unique view on the publishing industry right now. What are some things that you're gleaming from this opportunity that maybe people don't know about?
Well, one of the things that I've been thinking a lot about in the last couple of weeks, because we had a presentation by Random House. They do a yearly client summit where they invite everybody who is distributed by Random House to come in, and you know, it's a chance to make better personal connections, but also to talk about how to do what we do better. And one of the presentations they gave was on metadata. And in this case, what they're talking about is all of the information that we give Random House for them to be able to sell our books better. And because it's such a big list, you know, in a Random House catalog might have 800 titles in it. And the Random House reps are great, but even they can't read 800 books every season. So what we have to do is give them these kind of shorthand bits of information where they can, you know, I can hand them a TI sheet, a title information sheet for Emily in the Hollow World that says, you know, a great introduction for new science fiction readers, you know, takes familiar tropes from Jules Verne and makes them fresh for a new generation. And the idea that there's different levels and types of information you need to be ready to be able to give somebody, either to help them sell your book for you, or just to be able to position your own work for different markets, is something that I've been thinking about a lot. So I actually, as a thought experiment, I made up a TI sheet for Celebromancy, the second book I have coming this summer, and thinking about that book as a sales and marketing guy let me kind of approach my own work in a couple of different ways and gave me some things to start from when I'm going to get ready to gear up and do, you know, promotion and publicity planning with my agent and my editor. So, you know, I think that people who are trying to get into publishing now and be writers, you know, make sure that you're reading what agents are saying, what editors are saying, what people who are self-publishing are saying. You know, whatever path you want to follow, make sure that you're reading what other people are doing right now. And I would say it may be really important not only to look at luminaries in the field who are really established, but people who are just a couple of years ahead of where you think you are. You know, look at someone who has had their first book out in the last couple of years. How did they break in and make their connection? What did they do for promotions? Because the advice that somebody who got started in publishing 15 years ago as a writer would give you may not really be as applicable anymore versus somebody who is just a couple of years in. So like I've got friends now who are trying to get their first book ready to go to an agent. And that process is very present in my memory because it's not too long ago. So I would say you definitely want to engage people at varying levels of experience. And then, you know, you have to gauge advice and see how well it fits yourself, but don't only look to the top of the field in terms of most established people. You know, you can listen to advice from, you know, from William Gibson and Stephen King, but you're entering into a publishing world that's very different than the world was when they got started.
There was, I sent out a question on Twitter. Anybody that had questions for you in publishing, let's see, Walt Rosenfeld, at Walter Rosenfeld said, why don't you do more cross-genre mysteries? And I think he was kind of alluding to his book being half Angry Robot Books and half Exhibit A. How do you guys approach that? The blend between the, so Exhibit A being the thriller crime branch of Angry Robot Books, and then Angry Robot.
Well, the way we do our acquisitions is all kind of integrated. So there's three imprints under Angry Robot, which is then owned by Osprey. So Angry Robot is kind of the fiction division, and Angry Robot is sci-fi fantasy, Strange Chem is teen sci-fi fantasy, and Exhibit A is crime, mystery, and thriller. So if a submission comes in, it'll come into one editor or another. But then if it seems like it might cross into a different editor's purview, you know, we definitely talk about it. It's a small enough house that if Lee Harris, for the senior editor for Angry Robot, gets really excited about something, but he notices that, you know, it's maybe better as a teen book, you know, he'll read it and then he'll pass it on to Amanda Rutter, who's our Strange Chemistry editor. And we make the decisions on what books to buy and where, what to assign them to all together as a house. You know, so I'm in on the call doing sales and marketing. We have our sub-rights seller who's in on the call, and Mark Escone, who's the managing director. So we've got, you know, five or six people all on the call at once. And we've had books where they've come in and they've been, it's a little bit Angry Robot, but it's a little bit Strange Chemistry, but it's also a little bit Exhibit A. And we talk about it. And I think the most important thing is, do we fall in love with the book? And if we're in love with the book, do we think we can help it succeed in the market? Because if we love a book, but we don't think that there's a way for us to help it succeed in the market, we're not going to try and bring something on that we don't think we can succeed with. So there's a commercial side, but then there's really the dominant one is how well we connect with the work. And I think that if you've got something that straddles genres, right now we're only taking agented submissions unless we do an open door, which we've done a couple of times, then you'll want to work with your agent and say, well, I know that Angry Robot has this division and that division. I'd like to send it to them. And then maybe the agent can use whatever contact that they have. And once it's in our submissions pile, if one of the editors gets really excited, we'll definitely work with somebody on making sure that we put it in the right place. If it's a little bit, if a little bit more supernatural of a thriller, if it's a supernatural thriller, maybe it's Angry Robot. If it's a thriller with some supernatural elements, maybe it's better for Exhibit A. And I think marketing-wise, that comes down to who's the best reader for this book. If more of the best readers are in one category, that's probably where we'll put it. And I think that that's something that self-publishing has a great advantage in, is that self-pub doesn't so much have to do shelves by either or. You know, you can do something that really straddles those boundaries. But we've had good success at Angry Robot with stuff that is cross-genre. You know, we have Dead Harvest by Chris Holm that's very much Angry Robot, but also Exhibit A. And we have, you know, some other things that are, you know, they're really kind of out there. Dead of Winter by Lee Collins is a Western. It just happens to also be a weird Western. So I think it's easier to publish weird stuff now, especially with publishers like Angry Robot and other smaller independent presses that are taking chances on people who might otherwise not be really easily served by strict subgenre categories.
For people who haven't heard of Angry Robot Books, anything else you'd like to mention to them about who you guys are? I know we didn't really get to talk about the robot trading company, anything like that.
So yeah, Angry Robot was kind of birthed out of the minds of Mark Gascon and Lee Harris. And for the first, you know, good chunk of time, Angry Robot was really them. And, you know, it started with HarperCollins and then went to Osprey. And, you know, the most notable books we put out are probably Zoo City by Lauren Bucus, which won the Arthur Clarke Award. I think that's the 2011 award. But we've also got a great array of authors that we picked up over the last couple of years. And the things that I think stand out about our work, the books that we put out, are the fact that they're a little bit more different. You know, there's a lot of stuff that you maybe wouldn't see from other houses. You know, books like Blackbirds by Chuck Wendig it's technically urban fantasy, but it's really intense and it's very rural rather than urban. And we have other works that are just kind of a bit off center there. And we like to make fun, make a lot of fun out of the fact that we're a little different. Lee Harris does these cool file under categories for Angry Robot books, where it'll be, it's kind of like tagging under Amazon, but it's mostly for fun. And it gives you a little dose of the flavor of what we do. Another thing is that since Mark, who's the managing director, has spent a lot of time as an art director, he puts so much time and so much love into finding the exact right cover for the books. And you know, when I was at Worldcon and we were exhibiting, this was last year at Chicago, I totally lost track of how many people were like, "I love your guys' covers." And the cool thing there is that we do the same cover for US, for the North American edition, as the British edition in like 99% of cases. So the UK cover market, for people who aren't familiar with that publishing world, is fairly distinct. So we managed to kind of shoot the moon and thread the needle and find that right balance. So the packaging is really cool and it's a bit different. And our authors are always talking to each other. We try to make Angry Robot really be a family, where, you know, the different authors, even from different imprints, will be reading each other's work, blurbing each other's work, you know, talking on social media. So we're trying to take every advantage that we can of being a smaller publisher and really being customer and reader focused and reader facing in the way that we do things. You know, we try to have fun while we're here, because we're in books and publishing because we like, you know, we like reading, we love engaging with readers. And it's, if we can make a living at it, that's really good, because then we can keep doing it. So it's really fun to be an Angry Robot. And I would definitely invite people who aren't familiar with the house to, you know, check out some works, look up some of our authors, you know, see how everybody's talking to one another.
Awesome. Well, thanks, Michael, for coming on the show. We're going to cut it here and do another interview discussing your book, Geekomancy, and more about urban fantasy.
Excellent. Thanks so much for having me on. I hope that, that what I had to say was helpful for some people as they try to navigate this this very wacky but exciting time in publishing.
I would like to thank Tim once again for helping us provide content for the show. Please check out Tim's website at timothycward.com. You'll also find the page there for Audio Tim. If you're looking for more podcasts to listen to, there are about 47, 48 episodes up over there, so check it out. Link in the show notes too if you forget the URL. All right, let's take a look at three books I think are very exciting that have come in to the studio, and I want to share them with you. And the first one here, you know, we recently had R.S. Belcher on to discuss The Six Gun Tarot. We've been talking about Tincture by Matthew D. Jordan, and so it's only fitting that I would receive The Dark Tower Companion by Bev Vincent. So if you love The Dark Tower, then you need this book. This is your Bible for all things Dark Tower. Stephen King says of it, "Wonderful, opens doors to Roland's world that that not even I knew existed. And that's fairly typical, I think, of authors who write these massive series. They can't keep track of it all, and they actually sometimes rely on fans to help them keep the details straight. So The Dark Tower Companion should be out now in bookstores. So here we have a book from our good friends at Pyre, and this is Toxic City Book 2. The actual title is Reaper's Legacy from Tim Levin. 2 years after London is struck by a devastating terrorist attack, it is cut off from the world, protected by a large force of soldiers known as Choppers, while the rest of Britain believes that their ex-capital is now a toxic, uninhabitable wasteland. It's a little post-apocalyptic action there. Book 2 of The Toxic City. I'm not sure if this is a trilogy or not, but again, Reaper's Legacy by Tim Levin. And then lastly, we have Paul Cornell's tour novel, London Falling. And we had Paul on the show a couple of years ago, if you remember, where we discussed him and working for Doctor Who. And at that time, I didn't even ask him about his comics. He had just signed on to pen some big issues of Superman, and I didn't even know that, so I totally missed it out of that one. But now we have his novel here, and this is about police officers Quill, Costain, Sefton, and Ross. And they know the worst of London, or they think they do. While investigating a mobster's mysterious death, they come into contact with a strange artifact and accidentally develop the Sight. Two books taking place in London. There's a theme going on here, my friends. So there are three titles for you to check out. This one, again, London Falling by Paul Cornell. I'd like to thank everyone for listening, as always. Appreciate it. And we'll have part two of this interview for you real soon. Please visit our website. We have a feature there from Faith Hunter, who discusses the importance of beginning a story well, and she gives some samples and examples of great openings, and she explains why she likes those openings. Also, do join us on Facebook and Twitter, if you will. Next time we have a book contest running, that will be your best avenue to learn about the contest and to enter the contest so you can win a free book. We will see you again soon. Take care.
Visit Adventures in Sci-Fi Publishing for show notes, links, reviews, special guests, videos, and more. Email us at adventuresinscifipublishing@gmail.com. Sound effects from the Free Sounds Project. Music by Asymmetry, found at musically.com. No authors were seriously damaged in the making of this podcast.